Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to the masterclass of the System Club. And wow, I've got something really exciting and unexpected. It's great that life can surprise you every now and then still. I hope everybody knows the epically successful headline, "Do You Make These Mistakes in English?" We talk about it all the time in direct response circles. We know it's one of the longest running, if not the longest running headlines in history. I believe it ran 40 years. And we all kind of knew that, you know, it was part of a business run by a guy named Sherwin Cody, and he had a language school, and we kind of left it at that. We were just all amazed at the durability of the headline, because it's such a rare thing in direct response. I mean, headlines really are almost seasonal sometimes, and for something to last years, let alone 40 years, is unbelievable. Well, one of my students put in my hands a book called Do You Make These Mistakes in English? The Story of Sherwin Cody's Famous Language School. And the author is Edwin Battistella, and he is a professor of English and writing at Southern Oregon University. And Oxford University Press took his work on this subject and put it into book form, and I recommend everybody, if you can get your hands on it, get it, because it is a really deep dive into Sherwin Cody, his life, his business, how he evolved, how he got to this point. And I think for those of us that are focused on the marketing side of things, the creative side of things, we have to always remind ourselves there's something on the other side of that ad. You know, there's a human being, and there's a business, and there's a philosophy, and this business ran for quite a long time and helped a lot of people. So welcome, Edwin.
Thanks. It's great to be with you. And thanks to your student for connecting us.
Yeah, I'm. It's just kind of, I can't tell you how thrilling it is for us to have a book like this. Because a lot of, one of the things that we promote to our members and students and colleagues and everybody that we work with is that these old school direct marketers really have never been surpassed. You know, we've done different things. We've used different mediums, but we haven't gone beyond them in terms of just making things work with words on the selling side. And we're always studying people like Cody and John Caples, and then you refer to Maxwell Sackheim in this book and all of his colleagues. And these were the real, they were like the Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio of advertising. And there's so much to be gained by paying attention to them. So let me ask you, the first question is, how did you come to get fascinated by Sherwin Cody and devote an entire, and I have to say, excellent book to the subject of him and his work and his life?
Well, it's a funny story. I first became aware of Cody when I was a kid, and I saw the advertisement in the back of a comic book, and I sent away for the free invention that was going to improve my English, because I was probably just the sort of client he was looking for, and I got the prospectus, and I sent away for the school, the lessons, and they were a lot of fun. I read them over the course of a year. And then 30 or 40 years later, I was finishing up a book on the culture of grammar, and I came across Cody again, and I started looking into him, and I discovered that there was no biography. So I had some time on my hands, and I put together a research plan and dug into some of the biographical material, and I had long since lost the course, but I reordered it and looked through it. And then I just kind of filled in the gaps, got in touch with the surviving members of the Cody family, spent a little bit of time refinishing some of the old ads to reproduce, and I just had a great time working with that material.
I bet you did. Since you were a customer as well as a scholar, let me ask you a little bit about the customer experience. The Cody ad is a classic, what they call two-step advertisement. The ad isn't really the ad for the product so much as it is the ad to learn more. And you
yeah,
mentioned
exactly.
And you mentioned a prospectus, which I'm sure the copywriter who put this all together is thrilled, because in effect it was really you were really writing away for a sales letter, but it felt and read like a prospectus.
It did. It read like it was about a little 25-page book, kind of glossy paper, had some nice illustrations, and it talked about all the different things you might get from the course. So it was really, they really started out with the ad from the customer's perspective, and then they sent the prospectus in, and it really segmented different groups that might be interested in the product and told you what you would get from it. And then he did that sort of classic thing where you buy it on the installment plan. So you would get it for, I think, $1 a week. And then as long as you kept sending in your dollars, you'd get the next installment. So you're never plunking out too much money at once.
My goodness. So in order to consume this particular course, you had to remember to send your dollar in every week?
Well, they would remind you. They'd send you a little postcard, and you'd send them the dollar, and they'd send you the next installment.
My goodness. We certainly have had some inflation since then. So because so many of our listeners are business owners, I'd like to go over this end of it as much as possible, because this is fascinating. Because I've never met anybody who was a customer of Do You Make These Mistakes in English, or the Sherwin-Cody famous language school. So there was the ad, which we're all familiar with. Then there's the 25-page glossy prospectus, which you say covered all the bases and really filled out the picture of what people could expect. What was it that, and this is just purely subjective and based on your memory, which is fine because we're really dealing with impressions here. What was it that made you think, oh, this is going to be good? You know, for me in particular.
One of the things that there was the headline in particular. Do you make these mistakes in English? And it had the U in it, so I knew it wasn't just here's the master of English, come study with me. It was about me, and it had some common errors in English in the ad that sort of spoke to my insecurities as a teenager. And then when I actually got looked at the prospectus, it talked about this scientific invention that Sherwin-Cody had patented, and I keep meaning to go and look up the actual patent. But the patent was basically a workbook, and you would do a self-assessment and identify what were the things you needed to work on. So it was a little bit ahead of its time in that whole kind of learning assessment, outcomes assessment model. So he would give you this little test, and then you could decide on your own which parts of each weekly lesson you thought were the most important to work on: punctuation, exposition, grammar, and so on.
So there was a test every week, or a diagnostic?
There was a test at the beginning. Okay. And that would basically set your sort of plan for you. And it was really sort of self-paced, self-directed instruction. So his whole philosophy was that it should be about the consumer, not about the grammar itself.
And that really was way ahead of his time.
It really was. And that's why he called it a remarkable invention. I was sort of expecting I might get some kind of magic pill or something, but it turned out that I had to do some work.
Well, that is a common approach in direct response advertising, is to imply that it's going to be instant improvement. But then, of course, the important thing, and then he certainly delivered on this, is that he actually delivered something of value.
Yeah, exactly. I looked at it as a linguist as well as a historian, and a lot of the things that he was proposing were way ahead of their time linguistically. And he sometimes gets a bad rap as a kind of stodgy old prescriptive grammarian, but he really looked at it in terms of what are the things that will cause you to be judged by others and how can you get those things under your control?
You know, it's interesting, and you may or may not be aware of this, but it's interesting how many innovative thinkers have used the direct response channel to get their work out. In other words, they may not, at the time they came up with their innovations, there might not have been a place for them. For example, there's a lot of financial newsletters where the writers would never be invited to write for the Wall Street Journal, and yet their stuff is really, really good, and they may be a little different and a little innovative, and so they sort of cut out the middleman and sell their ideas directly to the public. That also happens in health, where, you know, the medical system works a certain way, and it's information starved in a lot of ways. And so to fill the gap, various people who are researchers or just really, you know, very interested in helping people promote their own health, they'll put together a newsletter or some kind of a product to reach the public. So it sounds like he was one of the pioneers of that too, of cutting the middleman out. You talked about his life, and I think I find his early life, I think it was very inspiring to me and maybe to our listeners, of how he struggled. You know, he did not have an easy time of it as a young person. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was interesting. I think that sort of also informed his ideas about direct mail and sort of selling directly to consumers, cutting out the middleman, as you say. He was born poor, orphaned, went to live with relatives, but he found his way to Amherst College, which I think was particularly dedicated to helping people who were needy. And even there, he was very entrepreneurial. I remember that he sort of put together a do-it-yourself copy machine. And I tried to figure out how exactly the chemistry all worked, and I couldn't quite reproduce it. But he would type up play scripts and other things for notes for students at the various colleges around there, and then reproduce them and sell them. So he was already an entrepreneur when he was in college.
And just to place people in time, roughly, when would he have been in college? I don't have his birth date here handy.
This would have been about the early 20th century. I'm thinking kind of late 1800s, early 1900s, that era. I think he made his way to Chicago around 1904 or something, but I'd have to look it up.
Oh, wow. So this is somebody that was born in the 19th century.
Yeah, he was born in the 19th century, but he was very much a sort of 20th century person. I remember him writing that he thought the language of business was sort of the new American lingua franca, and that he was very much dissatisfied with the old literary styles of the 19th century, and thought that I think at one point he wrote that the way businessmen write is the way English should be written, sort of colloquial, simple, correct, and directed toward the reader.
So it sounds like he was born in the 19th century, but he's a man of the 20th century, and it sounds like he actually helped in a small way, but in a meaningful way, form the 20th century in some ways.
He did. There, a colleague of mine at another university was looking at his role in sort of as one of the fathers of creative writing and his sort of approach to that. But in terms of business writing, a lot of the stuff that he did ended up being sort of taken over by the early business schools that were teaching clerks and secretaries, and they were basically the technologists of the day. And his sort of model is what they were teaching in the very first business schools in terms of business communication. And it's still very much the model, the sort of 7 C's or 5 C's of business communication.
Yeah, there was a lot of thinking going on back then about how to get the word out. about things, I think it suddenly became a lot easier to publish and print. I think after the Civil War, you finally had high-speed presses that you really never had before. And then you had this superabundance of print. I think maybe before that, print was so scarce that maybe people didn't even give much thought. I'm sure people did give thought, of course, to being more clear and direct. But once there was a flood of printed material, and therefore it became a hyper-competitive market, people had to give more thought, I think, I'm just guessing, to making their writing more appealing, more accessible, more direct.
Exactly.
Yeah, and he would have fallen right into that.
He did. At first, his very first idea was that he would be a great novelist, and he tried that and discovered that he was really only a mediocre novelist. So he discovered that he had a talent for business writing, applied himself to that, and then somewhere around the 19-teens, he decided that, the way to do this wasn't so much giving individual tutoring, but to put together this virtual school that was could use the economy of scale, and it just worked out great for him after that.
The way you put that, I realize he was a pioneer on another front. I mean, now virtual education is a big deal. But there wasn't a whole lot of that going on at the turn of the century.
Yeah, and the people that could go to college, as you say, tended to be the children of the elite, generally males, Cody particularly, he mentioned women in his ads. He mentioned workers. He mentioned immigrants. So he was really sort of casting a wide net for people that either wouldn't have access to colleges and schools because of their location or because of their social situation. It really was a sort of pioneering idea. And there were some others that did that as well, the international correspondence schools and the president of Harvard University, Charles Norton Elliott, I believe, put together the Harvard Classics around the same time. And he used the same sort of advertising method that Cody used. It was a little bit later, so he may have gotten the idea from Sherwin Cody. The idea that, if you buy this 5-foot-long shelf of classics, devote 15 minutes a day to reading them, you can come away with the equivalent of a college education.
Mm.
Distance learning.
Yeah, and to expand on that a little bit, to provide some historical context, I mean, I know, for example, that my father, had World War II not come along, there was no chance he was going to go to college. That was as likely as him going to the moon. And because of the GI Bill, suddenly this guy from a very poor family suddenly could think about going to college, and he got the chance, and he made the most of it, and he excelled. And we may have some younger listeners that can't, college is kind of, it's a little expensive, but you can kind of wing it. Not in the 30s, you could, when you talk about the elite going to college only, and especially, I mean, when you go back even further to the turn of the century, it really was a place only for the wealthy. The idea that you'd have merit and somehow make it into college was a pretty rare little heard of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, Cody's experience at Amherst, where they sort of took a chance on him, may have influenced his thoughts about egalitarianism and education. And the GI Bill after World War II was, it was a great thing for lots of folks, but it sort of spelled the end of Cody's course as well, because now there was less need for his type of virtual education, because colleges were expanding and there was this opportunity for the GIs in particular to get the face-to-face education.
Well, it's, yeah. it, it's a good thing, right? You know, that we evolved as a society so that patch, that remedy that he created wasn't so necessary. But
yeah, no, it was. But for its time, it was really very sort of innovative and progressive, and you see this in some of the lessons and some of the commentary on grammar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's very sort of forward thinking in terms of the idea that, you know, language changes, and it's not this idea that you need to, you know, talk like Shakespeare or John Adams or Thomas Jefferson, that English is going to be evolving, and that the best way for people to get ahead is to sort of understand what things are going to be, what things people are going to judge them by, and adapt to that.
You know, what a wonderful thing he did for so many people to give them access to this kind of information.
I guess one of the other things I that always sort of fascinated me, and it might be interesting to your students, is he put these ads in all sorts of different magazines, women's magazines, the back of the New York Times Book Review for about 50 years.
Wow.
Comic books, the mystery magazines, just dozens and dozens of adventure magazines and so on. And they would all, invariably when there'd be a different ad or a different magazine, it would go to a different post office box. So he would actually track which ads were doing the best that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it would go to the Sherwin Cody School in Rochester, New York, box E or box H or box whatever. And that way he could actually do do the sort of data crunching that, now everybody does with computers and algorithms. But back then, they basically did it all by hand.
Wow. Do you know if he altered his ads based on the publication?
He did. He would do different things in different publications, different sizes of ads, and occasionally he would experiment with a different version of that classic ad. The text usually stayed the same, but he would have things like, you know, meet the man who mastered English. And at one point in the 1950s, as business was failing, he actually put in a sort of New York accent headline that said, "Do you make these mistakes in English?" And it was reproduced in Advertising Age, and they sort of made fun of the kind of desperation of his appeal at that point.
Hmm. You know, I see another one of the many great things about your book is you've got a bunch of ads and other artifacts from that era, and one of the headlines is kind of fun. Maybe you could tell me if you know what the context was for this one. It's two men, and they have those little bubbles, and one saying, "I never liked to study English," and then the other guy goes, "This isn't study; it's like a game." And then the headline is, "The man who made it fun to master good English."
Yeah, sometimes I put that on my door as a little cartoon. One of the things that he was very much against was the way that English was being taught at the time. He saw it as being kind of taught by drills, and they would sort of copy things out and correct sort of random mistakes in the classics. You know, look for a misplaced pronoun in Shakespeare or something like that. And he thought it wasn't very relevant to the kind of writing people were doing. So he set it up as a kind of set of quizzes. And basically in the lessons that you'd got, you'd get basically a little quiz, and there'd be two choices. And you'd pick the one that you thought it was, and then you flip over the page and you can see if you got it right. So he treated it, he saw himself as treating it like a game, I guess, you know. So sort of like you could think of it as an online grammar quiz today, mm-hmm. which are surprisingly popular.
Really? Is that so? I didn't know that.
It depends on your definition of popular, but
you mean,
yeah, people will do them.
Cool. I see one of the things you've reproduced in the book is lesson one, the cover of lesson one,
mm-hmm.
and it was broken down by day. So Mondays would be expression, Tuesday would be spelling, Wednesday would be punctuation, Thursday grammar, and Friday conversation and reading.
Yeah, exactly. So he would sort of work through the week and then try to give you a little uplifting break on the weekend. And some of the reading things are actually bits of his biography. So that's where I got a lot of the great biographical details from.
Oh, okay. I was wondering where all that came from, because you had a tremendous amount of detail about his life. And this course, this one that you have reproduced in the book, or the title page, came out in 1918. And to give, I don't know, for some reason I feel compelled to give family stories as part of this interview, but to give people context, at that time, my grandparents, or my grandfather and his family, were living in a five-story walk-up tenement, and my great aunt says there was only one source of water for that entire building. It was a pipe in the backyard. And if you needed water, you went downstairs, you filled the buckets, and you carried them up. And that was the way people had to contend with only 100 years ago. So this getting this kind of intelligent help from an informed person for the people that took advantage of it must have been like manna from heaven.
Yeah, it was interesting because they were basically sort of small pamphlets, right, maybe 18 to 20 pages long each. And it was the kind of thing you could put in your pocket and take on the bus or the however you were getting around to work in a city. So it was the kind of thing that you could study on your own while you were, going someplace. And
it's interesting.
It really focused on the whole idea of that generation of the early 20th century of kind of learning to get ahead and lifelong learning, and the fact that if you sort of apply yourself, you can really get anything done. And that was sort of Cody's story, and he continually came back to that idea in the course.
Now you mentioned people reading it on the streetcar. I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I'm curious. Now, of course, in New York City, there are subway ads in every subway. They run on the top section of the train above the windows. And I firmly believe that I got a lot of my advertising copywriting instruction at an early age riding the subway because those
were
very
for sure. I think that's probably right, because I remember that I was a grad student in New York, and I remember riding the subway and seeing all those ads, and sometimes I would think that they were very sort of similar to the kinds of things that Cody was doing too.
Yeah, and in the old days, and they don't seem to do that this much. Oh, you know what? The most famous ad when I was a kid, if you can read this, it was written in some kind of modified shorthand, not real shorthand, but kind of like a shorthand that a normal person could read. And it said, if you can read this, you can get a good job. So it was like you and then CNRD, right? If you can read this.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a pull-off, which they don't have anymore. I don't see those on the – maybe they're banned or something. But in the old days, there used to be, and you'd rip one off. You'd rip a coupon off the ad, and then you'd write in. I'm wondering if they had ads on the subway in those days, it would have been a great place for him to advertise.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good I'll have to look into that a little bit.
Well, you mentioned his journey to Chicago, and of course Chicago was one of the great, great, great centers of the whole direct response revolution. You had Sears and Montgomery Ward, and then, of course, Maxwell Sackheim. Tell us a little bit about his move to Chicago and the great advertising people that he hooked up with and how they helped him.
Yeah, that's where he sort of, when he went to London for a time to try and be a writer, and that didn't work out. And I think he decided that Chicago was the city that was growing.
Mm-hmm.
And he made his way there, and he would do sort of business consulting, help people write letters, develop materials for them. He connected with the great Maxwell Sackheim, And he also got involved with the early school efficiency movement. So this is, you probably went to a school that had a homeroom, and then you would sort of wander around to other rooms to do the different classes and things. That was this sort of innovation of scientific management in the early 20th century. They called it the platoon method. It was supposed to sort of be a more efficient use of space in schools. And I think it originated in Gary, Indiana, or around then. But Cody also got involved with the idea of educational testing and things like that when he was there. And that was probably part of the way he developed the idea for this course. And at some point, he must have realized that he could make just as good a living by selling a product than by being a consultant over and over again.
This I laugh because this is a lesson that a lot of us who started out as writers have learned. I always say that, you know, we start out as writers and then we realize that, gee, we're not making any money, and then we think the publishers have the money, and then we become publishers, and then we realize they're not making any money either, and then we become marketers and we start thinking about, okay, theoretically, we can write anything, but the issue is how do we sell it? It's very, very interesting. So how did he meet up with? He met up with Sackheim, right? At some point, Max
Sackheim.
Yeah,
and I'm not exactly sure exactly how they met, but they may have collaborated on a couple of things. Cody may have been a consultant, but Sackheim wrote that first ad, and several others, and then I think eventually they kind of, Sackheim went his way and Cody went his, and but they always sort of, spoke fondly of each other, so it wasn't an acrimonious split.
Well, I heard that I actually remember when Maxwell Sackheim was still alive, because in his retirement, one of the things that he liked to do was stage hoaxes to fool. It's interesting. What a far-sighted guy. As I'm saying, I haven't thought of this in years. But when I explain this to you, you're going to say, oh, my God. So he used to stage hoaxes. He'd put out press releases about absolutely absurd, impossible things. And then when the news media would show up, he would say, see? These guys are can't be. They have no common sense. They'll buy anything. They're so gullible.
Great. I did not know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big Maxwell Sackheim fan.
Have you read his autobiography? I assume. Yeah.
I read it a long time ago. Yeah, and the I was just looking at the Ogilvy book a few days ago because I was trying to, I was telling my class about the two most powerful words in advertising, free and
probably you?
New, free and new.
Oh, new, free and new, yep.
Yeah. So yeah, they were doing some great, great things back then, really kind of innovative advertising. And one of the things that always sort of fascinated me, though, was just how stable Cody's ads were, because I was looking just kind of by way of comparison at the International Correspondence School, and they would sort of change their approach every few years. Sometimes it would be kind of appealing to insecurities, sometimes it would be appealing to sort of rising expectations. Sometimes it would be appealing to changing economic situations. But Cody managed to sort of find a formula that, and maybe it's a combination of the subject matter grammar, which is fairly unchanging, and his approach. But his ads were sort of remarkably consistent over the years.
Well, I believe you made a reference in the book to Charles Atlas.
Yeah,
he was also incredibly consistent, and it may well have to do with you know, big muscles are big muscles, and that sort of goes back to caveman time, and that's probably not, you know, the appeal of that's probably not going to change.
Yeah, they're sort of grammatical muscles or muscles.
Yeah.
And the other one that I enjoyed was Lillian Eichler's Book of Etiquette.
Mm.
She was another Sackheim protege, one of the first women in advertising, and she put together it was basically a picture book of etiquette, but it was a similar sort of formula, telling the sort of women who were sort of moving into the middle class what they needed to know not to be judged harshly by, you know, the people they came into contact with. I have a copy of it someplace, but it's a great little, the ads were excellent. They were sort of based on the same sort of formula, and the book itself was just terrific.
So this is another sort of universal issue. You know, we're all, it gets expressed in different ways, I guess, in different generations, but we're all concerned with how other people judge us or are going to judge us or how they're going to look at us, and we don't want to look bad. I have a saying that everybody wants to be cool, including grandpa.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why older folks adopt the younger generation slang. So I know that by the time some slang is getting to me, it's probably already on its way out.
Right, exactly. Hey, I'm going to take a slight detour, and I'm throwing this at you out of the blue, but somebody that's always fascinated me, and you did reference him in the book, is a man who was very influential in advertising thinking very early on, and his name was Walter Dill Scott. I realize I'm throwing this at you completely out of the blue. What did you find out about him? I mean, I'll tell you why I mentioned him, because I believe it was Maxwell Sackheim himself that said it was Walter Dill Scott that got him thinking about how to write ads. And I thought, wow. And I can't say that I've made an exhaustive study of trying to find out who this guy was, but I have looked, and it's not so easy to find out what his role in all this was. But I know he was a professor of psychology. That's about where it ends for me.
Yeah, let me think a little bit. I'm trying to not sort of just do this by memory. I think he was, a professor of psychology. And I know that Cody was interested in, you know, it was about that time when they were talking about intelligence tests, and the Army started putting in the IQ tests and things for new recruits and things like that. So I think Walter Dill Scott had something to do with some of that, but it's I'm a little bit hazy about that, so don't take my word for it.
Okay.
The one who stands out for me was Bruce Barton.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was an ad guy who was a big friend of, actually I did not know he went to college with Calvin Coolidge, and they remained friends throughout their life, but he was another one who sort of put together this whole new approach to advertising with The Man Who Nobody Knows, where he was sort of talking about, you know, Jesus as being an ad man of his time.
Right.
So yeah, he was the one who I found most sort of fascinating.
And you also mentioned the Schwab and Beatty agency, and of course Vic Schwab was a great copywriter. He was a protege of Sackheim, and he was involved in a lot of very popular books. He was involved in How I Raised Myself from a Failure to Success. Through selling. He was also involved in the classic, you know, mega hit, which of course I'm going to forget the name of, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
He did some of the advertising for Dale Carnegie's book. And that was interesting because that was actually such a big hit that was the time when Cody actually updated his course. So he kept it fairly stable until about the 30s, when How to Win Friends and Influence People came out. he did a revision because it looked like he was beginning to lose business to the idea that what you really needed to do to succeed was have a good personality rather than the sort of grammar and writing skills. So I think he that was a point when Sherwin Cody could see somebody catching up with him in terms of the business playing field.
Gotcha. So before How to Make Friends and Influence and How to Win Friends and Influence People, Cody would have been much more prominent. In other words, he was the guy before that other book appeared.
Yeah, and I think the whole sort of idea of what it took to be successful took a shift there. It used to be that you needed to have this kind of body of knowledge and expertise. You had to be a good writer, know a certain amount of literature and so on. And with the sort of How to Win Friends and Influence People shift, it became much more about how to be friendly and get along with people. So that was a kind of mid-20th century shift that is really fairly significant, I think.
And we're still playing it out with social media and selfies and celebrity Twitter channels.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the idea of what it takes to be successful and to sort of get along in the world changes periodically. And the people that are helping people be successful have to keep up with these.
Mm. I'm curious what you can recall about Vic Schwab. Do you know if he helped Cody with the revision of his advertising approach?
Yeah, you know, I'm not entirely sure. And it was a little bit like Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. I mean, sometimes people didn't get all the credit they deserved for some of these changes. So it was one of those situations where there were a lot of ideas floating back and forth, and different people might claim the credit along the way.
I would like to a linguist someday to do, because I know there are forensic linguists. In fact, one of them is, I live in Tivoli, New York, which is in northern Dutchess County. And
oh yeah, so, Rob Leonard.
Yeah, right. He's at Vassar,
yeah.
Right? Right.
Hey, so, yeah.
So maybe someday if I ever meet him, I'm going to ask him, because this is an intriguing one. I have a hunch that Dale Carnegie did not write How to Win Friends and Influence People. I think Victor Schwab wrote it, and I do that based on two things. I'm making that guess, and it's only a guess, based on two things. One, if you read Dale Carnegie's previous books, they're not very good.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And when you compare How to Win Friends and Influence People with How I Raised Myself from a Failure to Success in Selling, they're just so similar in tone and language and layout and everything. And I know Schwab worked. He always took credit for writing the ads. That was always clear, at least of the selling book. But I've never heard anyone ask, well, who actually wrote those books?
I do a class on language and law, and we were just talking about author identification and things like that. So this would be an interesting, project for someone.
I'll tell you why it might be, because one, talk about an influential book. I hear that the CIA makes that required reading for all of its officers. I mean, that's how highly they think of it as a way to help people socialize themselves. And then the other reason this is interesting is that it would be very easy to check, because you could check the two books against each other. You could check Carnegie's previous writing. You could check Victor Schwab's writing. He wrote a lot, and I don't think it would be a hard project to come up with some kind of a conclusive answer.
I imagine the Dale Carnegie people might be a little upset.
Well, The truth is the truth.
That's interesting. I had never thought of that. That's really great.
Well, I didn't think of it until I read one of Dale Carnegie's earlier books, and it's a perfectly serviceable book. There's nothing deficient in it, but when you read the How to Win Friends, it just pops. And then I happened to be simultaneously reading How I Raised Myself from a Failure to Success, and I'm like, wow, these books kind of sound a lot alike. How is Cody regarded, since you're a professor of English? Does he have any traction in people's memories as an innovator and somebody who did important things for the teaching of writing?
No, I think that's why I was able to do this book. Nobody else really seemed to be that interested in him. And I found one other guy who was doing a book on the history of creative writing as his PhD dissertation. And he was working on some of the things that Cody did in Chicago when he taught a creative writing course through the Chicago Tribune. So I think there's like a handful of people that are really interested in this sort of history of how some of these educational ideas came about. But, you know, for the most part, in English and linguistics departments, people are working on other things. And this is just one of these little things that kind of fascinated me because of the history and the visuals and things like that.
Gotcha. And you mentioned something fascinating to me. I have the name of one of my businesses happens to be The System. And this is a business that I have used to teach internet marketing over the years. And I was amazed to discover that was the original name of Business Week.
It used to be the System.
The other thing
I think Cody originally called some of his things the Cody System. So System was the idea of doing things systematically rather than by the seat of the pants was a sort of new idea 100 years ago.
Well, believe me, it was a new idea in internet marketing in the early 2000s. People were really not thinking clearly. They were just throwing all kinds of stuff up against the wall. Now, you make an interesting statement here, which is, and by the way, and from your book, he had something called the Cody System. Because this had to do with teaching business writing and speaking to businessmen. So did that precede his courses teaching the general public?
Yeah, that was the sort of precursor of a lot of this. And I think he discovered that, well, this works so well, I should make it available to everybody. And I think over the course of his career, there were about 150,000 people who plunked down their money to take his course.
Wow. And we have to remember the population was a lot smaller then.
Yeah. So he actually ended up as a millionaire in the days when $1 million was a lot of money, and became, sort of lived in, I think, Tarrytown, New York, or Dobbs Ferry, rather, he wasn't really a sort of social guy, more of a workaholic. At one point, one of his relatives told me he used to take his typewriter with him on, vacations to the lake and the park. Sort of the laptop of the day. But he became a sort of, well-known person in New York circles.
And there's something else in your book that I think my listeners should really be aware of. It sounds like Cody invented the negative option.
Well, yeah, I think he was certainly one of the first ones to use it. So, as far as I can tell, nobody used it before he did.
Wow, that is groundbreaking material.
It may be something that he and Sackheim were, but I mean, it was pretty much of that era. And then of course, it shows up in the Book of the Month Club, which I believe Victor Sackheim was involved in.
Yeah, Victor Sackheim, in fact, was the originator of the Book of the Month Club with his partner, and it's kind of a, you know, for those of us that are direct response advertising geeks, and there are some of us out there, this is explosive material. The idea that there was a negative option publisher before Book of the Month Club is amazing to me, and that, and I believe it, and it goes to show the creative ferment, I guess, that was taking place in Chicago in those days. And Cody and Sackheim knew each other, and they were probably kicking ideas around. It happens. I wish I could remember, but there was a cluster of very innovative direct response advertisers in Los Angeles all at the same time. And they sort of, I found out much later that they actually knew each other, met regularly. One of them was a guy named Joe Cosman, who invented the ant farm, if you remember that.
Oh, right.
And the spud gun, and a bunch of things. And there were some other guys, and I'm just drawing a blank, but it's interesting. There was, in that city, and as clear in Chicago too, these guys knew each other. They probably socialized. They probably shared notes with each other. There's one other thing, and we're coming towards the end, and I appreciate so much the time you share with us. And everybody, the name of the book.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to talk about this stuff.
Yeah. And so the book, again, is Do You Make These Mistakes in English? The Story of Sherwin Cody's Famous Language School. When Cody was teaching what you called applied psychology and applied psychology to sales practices, I'm going to just quote directly from the book.
Yeah.
Cody also understood the connection of narrative literature to applied psychology and of applied psychology to sales practices. As an advertiser and consultant, he promoted the formula of attention, interest, desire, and action. And as a mail order businessman himself, he advocated putting attention on the customer rather than the manufacturer. His, quote, scientific approach, unquote, to business involved tracking the results of ad campaigns to provide correction to improve sales. This attention, interest, desire, action is still to this day, for those people that are informed and are thinking clearly, is a formula we still use. So it's amazing to hear that this goes back, and Cody was one of the advocates of it as well. That's incredible. And that's like I said at the beginning of the call, this is all news to us. We knew this headline existed. we knew it had to be a successful business, because you can't run a headline for 40 years and without making money. But we didn't know anything about this remarkable man. So, Edwin, I really want to thank you on behalf of all the direct response advertising geeks in the world, for putting this book out. And
thanks for reading it, and again, thanks again to your student and all your students who are doing interesting copywriting work. We teach some of that here, and it's just great to connect with other folks who are doing that.
Great. Well, hey, I hope we get an occasion to talk again soon, and I think a lot of direct response people are going to really love hearing this call and learning all these things that you've uncovered for us.
Great. Well, thanks for your work as well.
Great. Talk to you later.
Bye.